So one of my most popular episodes, and in some ways controversial, are the two episodes I did with Jeff Frame and his phone call with his mom. If you aren't familiar with those two episodes, this man, Jeff, found out his dad wasn't his dad, and within a couple days decided to make a documentary about it. And on the second day, after he found out, he called his mom and confronted her. The documentary was never made, but the audio survived. And it's raw. It's uncomfortable to listen to, and it's absolutely brilliant. And people loved it. It really touched the nerve with a lot of people. In many ways, I think the things he said to his mom were the things that we all want to say to our moms, but can't or won't. So when I started making this episode, my interview with Jeff Frame, finally, I thought I was going to tell you listeners who hadn't heard those episodes to go listen to them first. But halfway through the interview, I realized I was wrong. That it's the opposite. I want you to listen to this episode first, and then go listen to the episodes, Phone Call with Mom, Part 1 and 2. Then you'll understand completely where Jeff is coming from and why he did what he did. This is Don Anderson, and I'm the host of Missing Pieces, NPE Live. This is Season 4, Episode 9, Jeff Frame, Finally.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's one thing to have conversations with all of us and ask us questions about our story. I think to get the glimpse into what actually took place between me and my mom is sort of a unique fly on the wall opportunity. It was very weird when you and I first connected for me to even dredge that tape back up and listen to it. It was the first time I had listened to it in years. And it was, again, very voyeuristic, I think. In a way that was, it was strange, but kind of out of body, I guess, a little bit. And I think for listeners, again, it's one thing to hear everybody's stories and to hear, hey, here's my story and here's how I found out and here's, and you find some commonality in those. But I think that there are things that I said to my mom that a lot of people probably wouldn't have minded to be able to say to their own parent when they found these things out. And I heard that because some of your listeners did reach out to me. I got some compliments as well about how level-headed I was, which I didn't feel that way that the day of, but I couched the whole thing in the idea that I was going to make a documentary about this because I've made a documentary film. And so to me, that was the way that I could compartmentalize what it was that I was experiencing. And so I was able to stay kind of relatively dispassionate in order to sort of make it as useful as possible.
Right. I was going to ask you that. Like one of my issues with being an interviewer, I get so involved in the story, I forget the project that I'm making, right?
Right.
And it seemed like you were on task as a documentarian and not a son in that situation.
And I think that allowed me to sort of separate myself one level emotionally. So I think it was as much a defense mechanism, really, as it was anything. And I used that defense mechanism for a few years in order to not even seek out my real dad. I kept using this idea, well, I'm going to make a documentary, but I need time and I need to plan it. And I'm busy with a lot of things right now, so I have to wait. And I'm going to do some research on him and see what I can find. See where he is, what can I learn about him. But ultimately, we're going to make this documentary. It allowed me to be as dispassionate as possible so I wouldn't break down as much as I might. It really was just to keep it from overwhelming me. The information was so overwhelming and life-changing to me that I needed a wall in order to filter everything through and keep me sane and not let it be something that was as big of an event as it was, I guess. And so I just wanted to make sure that this thing didn't break me. And I think that's how it comes across in that interview. I was surprised too to hear myself, to hear how level-headed I was, because I know that those aren't exactly the emotions I was feeling. So again, my story to some extent is that, you know, I thought I was born to one dad who ultimately was abusive. He was physically abusive to my mom, to myself. I didn't really know a lot about it, about him being abusive to me when I was a kid, but I do remember, even at five, I remember seeing my mom beaten. I remember moments of that. And then as I got a little older, my grandma and my aunt would tell me stories. My mom never did, but my grandma and my aunt told me stories about how they had found me, I think at like two, in my crib, just black and blue, you know, just really beaten up. Like the way a toddler you just wouldn't expect to find. And so that was the guy that I thought was my dad.
What was his last name?
His last name was Shepherd. And so that's what I thought my last name was Jeff Shepherd. And so they divorced when I was about five. I had a brother who was 3 years younger than me. We did the back and forth weekend parent thing for a couple of years, and then he remarried, moved away. And from the age of about, I think, 9 to 14, we lost complete contact with him. No contact at all. And, he had a lot of alcohol issues early on and temper issues and that sort of thing. But he remarried. I think the woman he remarried was really, really good for him. And she kind of whipped him into shape. And when I was 14, I kind of started to feel this pull again. I wanted to know my dad. And so I started to reach out to, you know, his brother and his brother's wife and trying to find information about him, you know, pre-internet, all that sort of stuff. So I'm just trying to track him down with phone numbers, and got in touch and found out that he was going to be back in Montana at the same time that I was. And I reestablished a relationship with him. And I thought, I'm just going to forget about the previous years and I'm going to work forward. So that was that dad. And it was a weird kind of surface level relationship, but you know, he tried hard at times and you know, things were mostly fine all the way through. So that was that story. My mom, then she remarried, she joined the Mormon church. She met a guy at church, when I was, about 8 years old that she married. They made the decision to have him adopt my brother and I. So our names changed to Johnson. Not a decision they asked me about. Changed our names to Johnson. I wasn't that tied to Shepherd either because I didn't have that much of a connection with my dad, especially at that particular point in time. But I was like, you just shifted my name. And I always had this draw, this pull to want to have my grandparents' last name, my mom's parents. I always kind of thought of Frame as the name that I connected with. I connected really strongly with her family. I didn't have a lot in common with my dad anyway. My brother seemed to. He seemed sort of a kind of a clone of him, and I didn't. And so I always attributed that in my head. I was like, well, I got my mom's side of the family, and he got our dad's side of the family. So in remarrying this guy, he seemed, you know, he was a guy that was taking on a single mom and two kids, and everybody thought he was great. And, you know, pretty soon after they got married, he became sexually abusive. You know, so that's something as a young kid that from really the age of like 8 on, I dealt with. And my mom also, and again, this is kind of where the vulnerability, this provides some context, I hope, for hearing how I sound in that phone call too, of I think, so my mom's vulnerability and her like emotional weakness and I don't mean weakness as a dig, but like she was fragile. My mom was very fragile always. And she wasn't someone that over time probably was going to be able to take care of herself very well in terms of employment or health. She had bad health. She was pretty later in life in particular, she was pretty obese, had a lot of health issues. And so keeping a job all the time wasn't going to be easy. Taking care of herself wasn't going to be easy. There were going to be medical bills, all that sort of stuff. And I kind of picked up on that from a relatively young age. I figured out that this guy, Brian Johnson, he...
Not the lead singer.
Not the lead singer of AC/DC. That'd be such a cool story. Other than the sexual abuse part, you'd be like, yeah, that'd be... see, I can joke about it. Look, I can be levity filled. But he, So he was, he was a hard physical laborer, you know, and he, you know, kind of took care of her essentially at a base level. And I think from a very young age, I sort of picked up on that someone was going to have to, you know, that someone is going to have to take care of her. And I remember sort of bargaining with myself even early on at the point where I understood that what was happening wasn't okay. First of all, you know, as a kid who deals with sexual abuse, and, you know, I will say in terms of church and Mormon church and a lot of the discussion that you get, ends up making you feel pretty guilty and shameful because of the talks about sexuality in the first place and the way that sexuality before marriage is impure and all those sorts of things that even when you aren't the one who's willingly participating and you're not initiating, et cetera, you almost can't help but take on some of those guilt and shame properties by proxy. You sort of just get the messages, whether they were intended for an abuse victim or not, they still kind of land. A lot of the object lessons they would use about being, once you're a piece of chewed gum, you can't be put back in the rat. It didn't matter that I didn't ask to be chewed in my mind, you know. So you feel very shameful. So you don't want to talk about it in the first place. And then I would bargain with myself essentially to go, I don't want to be in this situation. I'd like to go live with my grandparents. I asked at one point to try to go live with my grandparents and it didn't happen. But I also felt that if I told and he went to prison, there'd be nobody to take care of my mom. It's just the reality. Like, there was no one there to take care of her. I was too young. She needed somebody. Who else is she going to get? That was my thought process. And then even as time progressed, he even used that manipulation with me at times of essentially saying as much, you know, if I was more forceful in sort of rejecting, you know, a situation or like, no, you know, saying no or acting indignant or anything about it, he'd go, you know, you're right. You're 100% right. This is wrong. I should turn myself in. I'll go to prison, but I mean, I don't know who's going to take care of your mom, but you know, and he would use those tactics with me as a kid, but I already knew it. And yet he would reinforce it. He knew what he was doing. I mean, most abusers do. They know, they know who they're targeting, you know, and he probably saw, you know, a person with kids that, you know, he was, you know, probably a pedophile before, he met her. And then he knows how to manipulate. And that's what he did. And so to kind of flash back to what I was saying about how I felt when she was very emotional about the information, I kind of can't help but go, no. I've already done all of the lifting you up. You know, I've paid with my pound of flesh for your vulnerability. This one is not going to be that. If I sound a little more callous in that, and I think I do a little bit, it's partly because I had come to that realization. I came to it pretty quickly of like, I went through all this and you also lied to me all this time. Like that's, it felt like an even bigger betrayal. Like to take on as much as I did in my mind to protect her, to have her not be honest with me was sort of an extra slap in the face. And it was very difficult for me to sort of process those two things. And when I left high school, I really intended to take my grandparents' last name. And I had said something like that to her, but, you know, again, she teared up, you know, and talked about how hard it would be not to have the same last name. And that's why she knew she was taking Brian's last name. And so that's why she'd had us adopted. She wanted us to all have the same name. And I, again, I was sort of manipulated into this feeling of like, I'm not going to do something that hurts her. It's going to hurt her too much. And then consequently, I get married. I have three kids. They're all Johnson. I've got the last name, and I've given the last name to my kids of my abuser, which is, once I really could process that, it's a really sort of a dark feeling to be tagged with that. It feels very like he owns you or something, if that makes sense. And so that bothered me for years. I mentioned it at, at points in time to my wife, like how I'd want to change my name. But I never told my wife about the abuse.
Did you ever tell your mom about it?
No, never. I never did tell my mom about the abuse. Never once. There's part of me that suspects that she had to know at some level that there were things. And I think there were some things that she also understood when I was older how much I disliked him. I was pretty, you know, I was pretty cold towards him. She would say things like, well, your dad, and I go, Brian. I go, it's not my dad. It's Brian. Those sorts of things when we'd have phone calls. And you know, they'd come to visit and it was pretty obvious. I didn't want to be around him enough to where my aunt and my grandma also picked up on it. My mom's not a dummy. You know, she knew I didn't like him. So there's another thing that happened I'll share as well. I don't know if I've shared this anywhere else or not. I think she also knew that the possibility was there based on another experience that happened when I was, I think I was about 15, and I come home from school, and there's a member of the stake presidency, which is in Mormon terms, it's sort of all of these groups of people where you live geographically, you're organized into, it's a stake, which is a group of wards, which are the individual, you go to a ward every Sunday, and that's the 300 people or so that get together for church every week. So stake presidency is over those group of wards. And a member of the stake presidency, a clergy essentially, is at our house with a member of our bishopric, which would be over the ward. And I thought that's odd. There seemed to be something somber about it, and they wanted to talk to us. And what they did is they sat down and talked to us and said, "So here's a situation that happened to Brian, and you know, he'd always had this thing where he took a kind of underprivileged youth and big brother type situations. Even before he married my mom, he worked at like a camp in Ashton, Idaho, at a boys' camp. And so he always had this thing where he was taking kids camping and all that sort of stuff, you know, probably often for the fact that they were vulnerable. And so he had his kid that he had taken an interest in taking camping and taking him under his wing. And what they were there to tell us is that that he told them that he had taken this kid camping and the kid had asked him to touch him. And that when he did, then the kid started trying to extort him he wanted our car. And he was insisting that he get our car or he was going to go to the police. And so it got, whatever it was, it scared him enough. It made him, it sobered him enough to where he's like, I need to get out ahead of this. And he went to the bishop, went to the stake president. They had whatever meetings they had. And then they came to us to go, hey, we know. So we're here to support him. We're here to support you guys. We'll do whatever we can for you. This is a bad situation, but we're here to support. And there was a number of times when they said support him that I was like, are you serious? Like this is just his story. Do you guys even know the kid? Have you talked to the kid? You're not worried about the kid. And it was really sobering to me to go, it won't even matter. And I don't know if it was true or not, but that's how I felt. It won't matter if I go tell them my story. So anyway, that's an experience that happened that, to me, she knew that this had happened. She sat there with us. So I think she probably had some suspicions, but I also don't want to know. I don't want to know that she knew. I don't want to definitively know that because I think that piece of information would probably kind of be enough to completely sink any semblance of whatever I still feel. The idea, if I knew for sure that she had known about it, I don't know that's just a bridge too far, I think, for me to just. And again, detail is not a problem for me anymore. It's funny, I went from years of not talking about anything, and then it took me a little bit, but as soon as I started talking about everything, I was like, holy shit, this is liberating. You know, I didn't realize that this does take a weight off of me. So just to quickly, you know, reiterate, or to say, I didn't tell my wife about the abuse until I was probably 43 years old before I told my wife about the abuse. I told my grandma the year before because, again, my grandma and my aunt often recognized the they recognized in me that I didn't like Brian. My grandma and my aunt, my grandma in particular, would often say things like, why are you so mean to Brian? He's done nothing but take care of your family. He's a good man. I just don't understand why you're so mean to him. So it was very recognizable when people were around how cold I was and how, so they just thought I was an ass, you know, like that I was just an ungrateful kind of a, you know, how are you so ungrateful for this guy who carried, you know, insert fireplaces up apartment stairs to install and then drove truck and, like, you know, did what he had to do to take care of your family. And so I told my grandma a full year before I told my wife, because I was so afraid that she brought it up so often. I didn't want her to pass just thinking I was an asshole. I mean, I am, but not that not for
not
that,
in the way, you know, she
not in the way she thought. So I told her about it. And if she thought I was mean to Brian, she was horrible to him after that, to where my aunt was finally, she started asking her, like, why do you hate Brian? Why are you being so mean to Brian? And so my aunt kind of found out as well, or figured out. But so my brother was 3 years younger than me. My brother had, from the age of about 11 on, had pretty serious alcohol and drug problems. Learning disabilities and struggled in school and got in with the wrong crowd of kids and also became the wrong crowd of kids or whatever all goes into that. And so he was in and out of rehab quite a bit through my junior high and high school. It was really disruptive in our house. I mean, it was a tough time. Like, he was really angry and, you know, things didn't go well for him. And I, at the time, I just didn't like him because of all of it. I've definitely found a different level of kind of compassion for the things that he went through. He made a lot of his own mistakes and he was his own worst enemy, and we were never close. Never really. Like I said, he was he was a very different person from me. He was kind of a clone of my dad, even the way that they never spoke. They had a big falling out when he was in high school. He went to live with our dad, and he ended up, he got in a fight with them over something and kicked him and ended up calling CPS on them and all sorts of stuff. So he didn't speak to him for years through the rest of his life. But, like, if you would call and talk to either one of them on the phone, they would both sound exactly identical. I mean, you couldn't, if one of them called you and you didn't have caller ID, you didn't know which was which. So I had nothing in common with him.
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Do you think he suffered at the hand of your stepdad too?
I've spent some time with that. My aunt and I have talked a lot about it. I never thought so when I was going through. I think when I was going through it, I thought that I was the one taking whatever was there, you know. Now, my aunt suspects that he either was or he knew. And I don't also know. I can't remember for sure if there was a point in time where I maybe told him and he didn't believe me. I kind of have this vague recollection that maybe I said something to him and he blew it off and act like he didn't believe me. I don't know for sure. What I do know is that when my aunt called, so he had two stepdaughters, and one of them had like a 2-year-old or so, that they were around my mom and Brian quite a bit when Sean was alive. Sean was my brother. And my aunt, after she found out, she called them and said, hey, just don't leave your son around Brian. You just need to know. Don't do that. And she goes, oh, no. Sean had told us not to as well. She didn't get into details about exactly what Sean had said, why, but Sean had made it clear to don't, you know, leave their son, their little son, around Brian alone. So Sean knew something at some level, and whether he knew that because it had happened to him too, but he was still pretty close to Brian. They were kind of fishing buddies, and Brian bailed him out a lot, and Sean would, he and his buddies would steal all their electronics, and then Brian would go around to the local pawn shops and find them all and take them, you know, that sort of stuff. That was the kind of shit that went on. But I don't know for sure if he was abused or not. My suspicion is that it's entirely possible. And I don't know if that maybe contributed to his issues as well. And if it did, it's even worse that's, you know, that, that, it makes me feel kind of worse in a way that I survived it and he didn't. So he finally, at the age of 36, so this was, because this triggered the whole thing. At the age of 36, the Friday before Mother's Day, he committed suicide, hung himself. And, I had always kind of been waiting for a call that something tragic had happened with him. It just is what it was going to happen. I mean, he was going to drive drunk. At one point he drove drunk and ran into the side of a house, you know, and no one was in the room that he hit. And, he was going to drive drunk. He was going to wipe out a family in a minivan is always kind of what I worried. And, but it was always going to end tragically. It just was, I knew it. And I told my mom that in kinder terms of just, you need to prepare. Something bad's coming with him and you just need to sort of steel yourself up for it a little bit. And so when she called me and told me that he passed, it wasn't surprising to me. It was sad. But it just wasn't surprising, but it broke her. It was a Friday before Mother's Day. I went on stage the very next night cause I ran a comedy show at the time and, they're like, you can take the night off. I'm like, I can't, I just need it. And I did jokes about it. It was the only way I knew how to process it. And, it was tough. And it was really tough on her from the time that he died. She was broken before, but she was unfixably broken after. Like she gave up. We even had conversations at times. Like she used to come and take care of my kids while we'd go on vacation and they liked having grandma around. And then one time she came afterward and the next time we were going to go on vacation and the kids are like, does grandma have to come? And I was like, what's wrong? And they said, well, she's just sad all the time. She always just talks about Sean and wants to show us pictures of Sean and talk, and like I had to talk to her and go, hey, when we're going on vacation, the whole idea is that you love staying with the kids and it's fun for them to have you here, but I can't do it if it's going to feel awful for them. At some level, you just remember you've got these three grandkids too, and take care of yourself. And, I know that you're hurting and I we'll work through that any way we can, but I want you to also take care of yourself. And so that was what the time from Mother's Day until the end of the year. And I made one of those sort of end of the year, sort of self-indulgent Facebook, here's my start of the year, my reflection on the last year. And I basically talked about how, I'd had a really good year personally. And it was really hard for me to rectify and reconcile this idea that I'd had this really good year and my brother had taken his life. And so I had these real mixed emotions. And I had these mixed emotions about, was I not there enough for him? And, is there anything I could have done? And all that sort of stuff that I think you go through when someone commits suicide or dies or whatever, that that had a tough life. And I made this post and I said, I wish I could understand what he'd done or why. I wish we'd understood each other better. So shortly after that, I get an email from sort of a distant family relative that she and I had become pretty good Facebook friends and she'd comment on a lot of stuff. And she reached out in this email. She said, I read your Facebook post and I'm hurting for you. And I understand. She goes, but there's a reason why you don't understand exactly what he went through. And it's genetics. She goes, you don't feel the same way about things. And there's something I think you should know that everybody in the family has known and just no one will tell you. And I just don't think it's right. You don't have the same father. The guy that you think is your father isn't your father. It was a kindly written and kindly worded and compassionate thing. But I also thought it was just, I was like, oh, she's too out of the loop to probably understand what she's talking about. She is thinking about Brian, who's my stepdad, about him not being my real father or something. I just, in my head, I was like, this doesn't make sense. My family is too talky. They're too gregarious. There's no way that no one has told me this. And I showed my, I showed my wife, and she's like, there's no way. She's got something's off. And
she's no way that this woman's telling the truth. There's no way she's not telling the truth.
There's no way that it's not that she's not telling the truth. It's that she's misunderstood something.
Oh, okay.
She's sort of.
So your wife was agreeing with
you. My wife was agreeing with me. She's like, there's no way that none of us would have heard this. Your family talks too much. You know, I was like, it's very kind hearted of her. It's very compassionate, but she's wrong and she's heard something. She's misheard something. And so I thought, I'm gonna call my aunt. I'm not gonna call my mom. I'm gonna call my aunt. And so I call my aunt and I go, hey, I got this weird email from somebody that I said, I'm not gonna tell you who they are, but it's somebody who knows our family or knows enough about our family. They said that my dad isn't my dad. Like, is that something you know anything about? And my aunt just clams up, just silence. And I was like, holy shit. Like, no, this is true.
Right, because if it wasn't true, she would say, oh, no, she's right crazy, away. Right?
And I caught her so off guard. I didn't text her. I didn't give her any heads up. I didn't, you know, I just was like, I could tell right away immediately by her reaction. And then she says, that's something you'll have to talk to your mom about. And I go, no. I go, you're going to give me some information for sure. Like, you've got to give me, I go, I'm going to talk to my mom. But based on what you just said, I know you know something. So I need to know what you know because I need to go into this prepared. You know, mom, you know, this is her sister. You know, I'm going to need to process some things before I talk to her if this is what you're saying it is. And so she explained things to me. And so then I had that phone call with my mom.
Have I mentioned that Jeff does stand-up? Here's a little clip. The audio's not so great.
For a living, sir. That's what they want to do. Some of you are going to have doctors and lawyers, so you're real jealous because I've got Siegfried Roy up all over the door. That's all they do in their free time. They just look up tricks online all the time.
If you're in Southern California, you want to see Jeff live. He's headlining a show this Valentine's Day, Wednesday the 14th. It's going to be at JR's Comedy Club out in Valencia. I'll put a link for it in the show notes, but just Google JR's Comedy Club Valencia. If you don't know where Valencia is, it's out by Six Flags. And Jeff's also in a play. He's an actor. This guy does everything. He directs and acts in this play. It's called At Home at the Zoo, and it's playing this weekend, which is February 9th, is tomorrow, Friday. 2024, don't know when you're going to be listening to this. Don't go to Valencia if it's 2025 or beyond on February 9th. But February 9th, 10th, and then 16th and 17th, two weekends in a row, he's going to be playing. It's called At Home at the Zoo. It's playing out in Santa Clarita at a place called The Main. You can get tickets on Eventbrite. So if you Google At Home at the Zoo and Eventbrite, you will find tickets. I will put a link to it in the show notes. And for those of you all over the friggin' world, Jeff is going to have a comedy special coming out really soon, like a comedy concert. When it comes out, I'll post a link on Instagram and talk about it in future episodes. Back to Jeff on Missing Pieces, MPE Life.
I think that's why I share as much as I do, too, because I do feel sort of there may be some people that have listened to that and go, it's a little harsh. You know, it couldn't have been nicer. Or even the ones who don't feel that, I think that the story provides some context. I know that when I listen to it, I feel it, that I understand where I'm at and some of the things that I say because of the context of where I came from and the other things that had happened. And, you know, she said, so some of the things she said in the call of like trying, you know, I think she says something about, I was trying to protect you. And boy, that just, it hit so hard because I was like, you were trying to protect me by not having me get to know this other guy. And again, I didn't know him at that point. Maybe she was right. Maybe he was a horrible person. He might've been. I didn't know. He had hurt her, you know, in terms of emotionally. you know, he rejected her and that hurt. And so she thought he was an awful guy at some level, but that's jilted love, you know, that's unrequited or whatever. But for her to say that she did it to protect me, and I know that she wanted to marry a guy who, you know, physically abused her and beat the shit out of me, and then to marry another guy who sexually abused me, give me both of their names. I just thought, I know that you didn't mean to. I do know that. At the same time, you could not be more wrong. You just couldn't be more wrong in your assessment that you did that to protect me. You did it to protect you. You did it because you didn't want to deal with the emotional impact, the aftermath, the judgments like you talked about before, Dawn, the ideas of what that meant. You did it to protect you, and you were afraid. I think she may have said this in the phone call a little bit. I think she talked about something about she was afraid of losing me, and now I think she then broke down and goes, and now I have, or something. And
yeah.
And you know, the sad thing is, in a way, that she's not entirely wrong there, because our relationship did fracture pretty heavily after that. It was pretty tough. The way to have dealt with it was to tell me and to treat me like an adult.
So let's talk about your biological dad.
Yep.
So basically, I'll just tell the story if I remember it right.
Sure.
Your mom went to, he was in the army or something. She went to Germany. They were going to get married. She got there, basically got pregnant, and then he said he didn't want to marry her.
Yes. Although I think those last two details are slightly reversed in terms of, he was going through some stuff with his mom at the time, having serious, serious health problems. I think she had maybe just passed. And she was in a facility that he watched her deteriorate pretty badly. And he was really in a bad spot, it sounds like, too. And they had reconnected after he came back, I think, for her funeral. They had dated once or twice before, had worked together, et cetera. And then he asked her to come over to Germany. He was going to be stationed in Germany in the army. And she went. They were going to get married. I think it was okay initially, but not for very long. And then at some point he decided, this isn't working. We're not going to get married. And it was after that she thought she was going to go home, but she also thought she got the flu, and it turns out it wasn't the flu. She was pregnant, and they talked through whether or not that meant that, do we need to go through with this and get married? And he still didn't want to, but he wanted to be involved. He actually asked, I believe the way that she even put it to me was that he had asked to, he wanted custody of me maybe, or was open to that. And she wanted him to have nothing to do with me. And so she left and came back. And when she got back, her dad, my grandpa, sent her to Helena, Montana. I think that there was some sort of a home for unwed mothers there. I think the story at the time was she's going away to school, you know, she goes to some place somewhere. She has the baby, adopts it out. She comes home. You know, nobody really knows what happened. Well, she had me, and I was adorable. And she couldn't let me go and comes back home with me. And, I had great relationship. It's funny because my grandpa is the one who wanted her to give me up for adoption. And there was probably no one I was closer to through most of my life than my grandpa. Like, we had a really good relationship, which that one, my grandpa passed before I found this information out. He's one that I've been able to talk to my grandma and my aunt. I really wish I could have talked to my grandpa. I've talked to my aunt about it. I've talked to my grandma as to why he wouldn't have told me, because he was really, you know, he told me everything. He taught me everything. He was a real father figure in a lot of ways anyway. For him to not tell me is a real puzzle to me. They said it was because he didn't want me seeking out this other guy, because he had seen me have these other guys in my life that he didn't care much for. He didn't like either one of my stepdads. He didn't want me get involved with another one that might not be a great guy either. Again, he knew my mom's story about him. It's interesting because he was one person that I thought about telling. He did not like Brian at all. Never did. Just never really respected him. Didn't like him. But he didn't know. And I thought about telling him at one point about what was happening. It was one time when I was staying with him. And I didn't specifically because I kind of knew that what he would do would probably just kill him. And I thought about telling him specifically for that reason as well at one point. And then I thought, well, this is what'll happen. I'll tell him, he'll shoot him, and then he'll go to prison. And then there's still nobody to take care of my mom, you know?
God, I was going to keep track of this by last name, and I already forgot the last name you were born with.
Shepherd.
So Shepherd, so you refer to him as stepdad now?
I guess now it depends on how I'm telling the story or the context. The guy I thought was my dad, stepdad.
Because you just know. Said he hated, your grandpa hated both of your stepdads.
Stepdads, yeah. And, that, and you know what? I don't think I thought about it in those terms, but my grandpa knew it was my stepdad. So maybe I am just sort of starting to say that now and just referring to it that way. I don't even know if I've figured all that. That part of it, that is still sort of compartmentalized. From the time I found this information out, I thought, well, why is it my responsibility to reach out to him to tell him that I know? At first, I thought it was. I thought, oh, you know, great. Now I've got to have this conversation with him too. And then I kind of thought, you know what? It was sort of a one-sided relationship in terms of I was always the one to call anyway. Like I was never going to get a phone call from him. I would call him every couple of months. I'd call him. We'd talk on my way home from work, et cetera. But at some point, and I don't know if it was a really conscious decision, I just decided I wasn't going to call him again.
Just to clarify, so you're talking about after you found out he wasn't your dad.
Correct.
Then you started.
And I would have a conversation with him. If he were to reach out, I could have a conversation with him. I just didn't feel like I needed it. And I didn't feel like, I was like, I'm not taking that on. You know, you guys all knew I'm the one who didn't. I'm not going to be the one to have to call and start an awkward conversation. And I'm fairly sure that at some point he, his wife, and her kids, I think have probably seen something enough on Facebook. I think they know that I know. And, you know, I've disappeared essentially and my number's the same and, wouldn't be hard to get a hold of me and I'd take a call, but hasn't happened. I'm not going to seek it out at this point. It's been, now we're at like 10 years. So
you haven't, I'll put this in our MPE language. So your birth certificate father, after you found out he was your birth certificate father, not your real father, you haven't talked to him since?
Never, not once.
Not once.
Not once.
Oh, wow.
But we didn't have a tremendously dynamic relationship before that. It was a lot of work.
And back to Jeff's biological father.
All I really learned about it was that he had family from Missoula, Montana, and that she thought he maybe lived in Spokane and that his name was Rick Rosa. That's all that I really had to go on. I knew that he was about her age, maybe a touch older. So other than that, it was just she didn't know anybody who might know him at that point. I think she told me some information about the fact that she thought he had a brother who may have been a sheriff in somewhere near the Missoula area, et cetera, if I wanted to look up that. But she thought that he'd had family in Spokane and that might be a place to start. So that's the information that I had with that. My aunt didn't know much other than, I think his name. So that was it. And then I just started, you know, seeing if I could sleuth it.
And did you? Like how long did it take you to find him? Or
it didn't take me very long to find who I was pretty sure was him. It looked like he was in, Las Vegas or Henderson, Nevada, I think. Based on birth dates and stuff. And then, you know, you'd look up some information that had him tied to both Spokane and there. And I thought this seems like it's probably the guy.
And this was like 2013.
Gosh, where are we at? This is about 10 years ago. So yeah, it's right around 2000.
So the internet was big. It was
cooking, you know, it was a thing. It was, proven itself to be worthwhile. I sleuthed it enough to where I felt fairly confident this was him, but I really couldn't find much actual information on him. Like I couldn't find like a Facebook profile. I did find it looked from the records I was finding like he had a daughter and, so I knew her name and eventually, I did find a Facebook profile, and her name was spelled slightly different in the first name, like a K instead of a CH or something. one of the, or something about it, it popped up and I was like, I think this is her. And then I would kind of, you know, with, she didn't have it very locked down. Some people, you know, you go to look at them on Facebook and they've got all the privacy settings and like, good luck. You're not going to find anything. So she had stuff there and I kind of happened on a picture of her with, you know, with her dad. And, I looked at him and I was like, I could maybe see it. And then I showed a couple other people and they're like, oh, like, yeah. I was like, really? Like that? I showed my producing partner that I'd done documentary with. And he was he's like, oh yeah. He was, that's your dad. Like 100%. And I think I showed my wife and she was, I think less sure, but we figured out pretty quick. I was like, this is the one. And so I was able to see a few posts with him, but her mom had a Facebook profile that was locked down, so I couldn't get much information there. And he definitely didn't have a Facebook profile, so it was hard to get little bits and pieces of information.
And you reached out to him?
Not for a while, about 5 years. It took me 5 years. Oh, wow. I kept using the documentary as an excuse. I was going to research, and then I was going to figure out how to do it. But I wanted to know more about what I was getting into. And I couldn't find a lot. I couldn't find a lot of things that sort of gave me peace of mind that I wasn't walking. At this point, did I want to know my dad and know more about him? Sure, I did. But I also didn't want to walk into, a nightmare. You know, I didn't want to walk into more dysfunction. I'd come from plenty of dysfunction. If this was a bad situation and I didn't know that I wanted to open myself up to it. And then at some point it also became, I was also afraid to reach out, for fear of rejection. I was definitely afraid. What happens if I reach out and he says, I'm not doing this. I don't want to have anything to do with this. Am I up for that? And I didn't know at that particular point in time if I was quite up for it. So it took about 5 years and it was ultimately my, so I went through a little bit of a pattern where I saw her Facebook, what I thought was my sister. And then she posts a comment about Sister's Day and her sister. And I was like, holy crap, I've got two sisters, you know, like I've got two sisters. And so I saw a little bit of her sister's profile, which you couldn't see much. And then she posted something about Rick, you know, raising them as they're his own, even though they weren't his daughters. And I was like, oh, okay. So they're not my sisters. They're stepsisters. And then another sibling's day or something, she posted a picture of her with another guy that said, you know, my brother, John, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, oh, I've got two steps. And I'm pretty sure this guy, and I looked at his picture and I was like, oh, that's definitely my dad's son. So I was like, I do have a brother. And then so I...
Did he look more like your dad than you?
To me, he definitely did. Right. Right away, like I was, oh, I can see a resemblance for sure. I'm a lot heavier, and they're both leaner kind of look. And when I really look like my dad is later when I started sharing pictures of him in his 20s and me in my 20s. That's where we have similar, like, you know, head cock kind of pose and, you know, the way we smile and all this stuff. It was spooky. So I finally... My producing partner, his wife was going through it in Missouri. She was adopted and they were just opening up adoption records. And she was able to reach out, find her adoptive mom. Before she was able to meet her, she died of cancer. But she got to know her husband and then she had siblings from her mom. And their story, every time I was getting these updates, this is my producing partner and my directing partner, and I was getting these updates, and it was such a happy, like, everything was going perfect with that one. I was like, I want that. You know, I want that reunion thing. I want how that's going. And so he came in to tell me an update about his wife and her situation, and they had just gotten back, I think, from visiting or something, and I'm sitting in my office at work, and I go, screw it. And I just grab a phone, and I start dialing the numbers I found. I found my... what I thought was my dad's number, but I couldn't get through or it was disconnected. I found what I thought was my brother's number, a business number, and got a voicemail. I was like, I don't want to leave a voicemail. And then I found a number that was listed as his wife, and I called it, and it was her cell phone. And I said, I was like, gosh, I don't know what to say to her. I don't, you know, I go, is there a Rick there by chance? You know, and can I talk to him? And she's like, well, this is his wife's cell phone. And I just thought, please don't ask me anything. Just don't ask me any questions because I can't. I don't want to answer. And kindly, I think I've talked to her since, and I think she picked up on it. She's like, she had maybe an inkling this might be what it was because she knew about me.
Oh, she did.
She did.
Yeah.
Which is the other fear I had. That's the other reason I didn't want to tell her anything too, because I didn't want to also be the guy.
Right.
I didn't want to reveal. I don't know what his family knows. And I don't want to, my goal wasn't to drop a bombshell in their family dynamic, you know? And so I talked to him, and I talked to him for, gosh, must have been a pretty good hour. And he was pretty emotional. And he was beating himself up pretty bad over a lot of it. And, you know, and I pretty quickly was trying to reassure him that, look, I'm not here for penance. Like, you don't, I'm not looking to, you don't owe me anything at this point. I just want to see if I can get to know you. I appreciate that you're apologetic, and I appreciate that perspective and that you have that. But just, you know, I'm not here looking for an apology. I'm not here to extract anything. I'm not angry. I'm just here. And I kind of want to just see who you are and what I can learn and, you know, maybe get to know you a little bit. So that's kind of where I was. And it's been about 5 years now. It's been about 5 years that we've, been, and it's good. It's been really good. It's been nice. You know, I've kind of enjoyed sharing my story since. It's funny because I went from a point in time where I was very closed off and talked about nothing. I was very angry. I was very just angry, and I didn't even always know why. And since I told just that, tell my wife, and then starting to tell people, I went from not telling anybody to to be like someone who will just talk about it with people that are like, oh, you know, they get that look on their face like, oh, dear Lord, you were sexually abused, huh? Oh, you know, it's that quick reaction of like, that's, well, TMI, you know, and I get it. When you get excited about like, I'm healing, that's all heal. And they're like, we were fine until you started talking about it.
And then they're like, here's your change, sir.
Yeah, exactly. It's at the grocery store. Did you find everything you need? And I'm like, not healing. You know, are you doing okay? Well, my stepdad touched me, but, everything else is okay. You know, you just start talking about it. You just talk so openly. I mean, the thing I didn't touch on, I changed my last name. So I changed a few years ago. I don't remember how many years now because I'm losing track. I'm getting old. But I think we're at about 3 years in June. I finally made the decision. It was on my 20-year-old son, Aiden, and I went to visit, I think it was 20 at the time, my grandma for her 89th birthday. And I took him to some family. We have a family kind of memorial site. It's hard to describe it. It's like this concrete marker, like out in the bluffs in Wyoming that kind of points over, this area where my grandpa's parents and he and his siblings lived when they homesteaded, and it's all a reservoir now. And it was to mark one of their first brother who passed in a plane accident in his 30s, but it's this family monument that you hike to, and you got to find it, and it's not, you know, easy to get to if you don't know where it's at. And so I took him out there, and we spent this time doing this stuff, and we were driving back from Wyoming, and we just had a long conversation about it. And I was talking about it, and he kind of said, he goes, why haven't we changed our name? Because I talked to them about it when I first got this information. Right away, I told him I'd kind of wanted to change my name. He goes, why haven't we done that? And I go, I don't know. I just, you know, it seemed difficult. And he goes, is it really that hard? And he's the one who kind of encouraged me and pushed me forward. And we came home from that trip, and I basically told my wife, I go, it's time. And so 3 years ago, we went and did all the court stuff. And, you know, my wife and I and two of our kids, our oldest was away at the college at the time and didn't want to do it while he was dealing with courses and stuff. And which was fine, and he needs to come do it on his own time if he wants to or not. But we changed our last name, and it was sort of one of the last big burdens off my shoulders was being able to get rid of that Johnson last name and take on my grandparents' last name, which I don't know if I made it clear when I was talking about it. That's one of the things I discovered. I think I asked her in the phone call, what was my name at birth? And she said it was Jeff Frame because she wasn't married to anybody and her last name was Frame. So it was my name. And I'd always, the other thing I'd always felt like in terms of taking that last name is, you know, it's like, is it going to be weird? Are they going to think it's weird that I'm just changing my last name to Frame? And it turns out it was my name on my birth certificate at birth and I changed it. And it's been kind of the last piece of sort of unburdening and I love it. It's been really nice. It's nice to honor my grandparents instead of a guy that I have no ties to that was an awful person.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's actually a great way to end it. All right, man. Well, thanks for coming in.
Yeah, it's good.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, like I said, you're one of the most popular episodes, and I think people are really going to get a kick out of hearing the whole story. Again, I'd like to thank Jeff Frame for coming out, sharing his story with us. Don't forget, you can listen to his other episodes. One's near the end of season one. The other one's maybe the first episode of season two. I can't remember. They're called Phone Call with Mom, Part 1 and Part 2. Check it out. Even if you heard it before, I think you should listen again. And don't forget that Valentine's Day, next Wednesday, in the year 2024, Jeff will be performing. He's actually the headliner out in Valencia at JR's Comedy Club. I will put a link to that in the show notes as well. And don't forget about his play, At Home at the Zoo. You can get tickets for it on Eventbrite. It's playing this weekend in 2024, the 9th and 10th of February, and then the following weekend, the 16th and 17th. And it's playing at the Main in Santa Clarita. And don't forget, he has a comedy special coming out soon. I will post about that on Instagram and talk about it in future episodes. Stay tuned. I'd like to thank Billy Sullivan for all the music on today's episode. To find out more about Billy, go to sullystonemusic.com. If you want to leave a message for Don, it's donnpe@icloud.com. Follow me on Instagram, npe_life_podcast. And don't forget to leave a review and rate this episode. I really, really appreciate it. This is Don Anderson. I'm the host of Missing Pieces, NPE Life. And I'll see you on the next episode. Thanks for listening.